Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher, and my guest today is Steve Featherstone. He's a writer and journalist who has written a piece for the May edition of the New Republic titled Professor Carnage, about recent trends in police training. He's been on the program in the past to talk about the aftermath of the Fukushima disaster and the use of synthetic marijuana. Steve, welcome back to the program.
Good to be with you, Grant.
Now, you write in this piece about an approach toward policing called warrior policing. So explain what that means and where that comes from.
Yeah, in a nutshell, warrior policing is a style of policing that is, sort of turns a cop into a soldier, in a nutshell. It's been around, you know, for really since the advent of SWAT teams, you know, in the 60s. Mm-hmm. But it really didn't get rolling until the war on drugs in the 80s. And then I think maybe the best example would be, you know, the image would be like the LAPD of the early 90s and the Rodney King meetings. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's sort of the warrior cop, and we see a lot of that in the movies.
And the connection of that to the title, Professor Carnage, there's a gentleman that you associate kind of with this as the traveling evangelist.
Yes,
for this.
I call him in the article the godfather of warrior policing. I say that because he didn't invent it. He didn't invent warrior policing, but he has sort of taken advantage of this trend. His name is Dave Grossman. He's a former lieutenant colonel, retired from the Army, and made a career out of training cops to think like soldiers, to think and react like soldiers in deadly situations.
And how widespread is this view of policing as being warrior policing among police departments across the country? And also, would you think that it includes the police department here in Syracuse?
Well, it's entrenched. It's an entrenched part of police culture coast to coast. And you can't find departments vary. I mean, all departments are different depending on who the chief is, depending on, you know, the city that it's in, depending on whether it's rural or urban. But in terms of general police culture, it's widespread. Locally, I don't think Syracuse has had so much of a problem with warrior policing as you might see in other cities, like, say, Los Angeles, for example. Syracuse has had a history of instituting like neighborhood substations where mm-hmm. people from the community can go in and talk to a cop face to face, you know, tell them about their whatever the troubles might be. And then, of course, there's a civilian review board. So I don't think, as far as I can remember, I can't think of like a high profile case where someone's been shot under circumstances that have look bad on the police. Mm-hmm. I can't remember anything in recent history. So, yeah. I mean, I don't think it's been a problem here.
And in your piece, you have some musings about the connections between – possible connections between this way of thinking about policing and this way of training police officers to be warriors and this string of shootings by police of African-American citizens that have been generating a lot of press coverage and a lot of public protests over recent years. Tell me a little bit about how that works or could be associated.
Sure. I mean, if you think of the warrior cop, I mean, most of us have this image of the officer and sort of decked out in his black gear with his his bulletproof vest, which of course cops have to wear, the helmets, and then but of course on the side, you know, you have to a large degree departments have been fed through the Department of Defense program huge amounts of military gear, and so cops now almost not in terms of tactics but also just in appearance look a lot like, you know, special operations soldiers. And I think now this attitude and this approach is actually encouraged in the police academies and is encouraged in training on the job. I mean, I think people that go into policing today tend to want to adopt this kind of sensibility.
And tell me a little bit more about that training, because you do cite some interesting facts about how police officers are typically trained under this rubric of warrior policing in terms of how much time is spent in a police academy on different kinds of police activities.
Yeah, so in a police academy, when a cadet is learning how to be a cop, they have to learn all different kinds of things. The vast majority of their time is spent in on the range, learning how to use weapons and defensive tactics. But, very comparatively little, a fraction of that time is spent on things like de-escalation, conflict resolution, and that sort of thing. And that reflects that warrior mindset, because it's the idea that one former cop that I interviewed for the story, who's now a professor at University of South Carolina, put it this way. It's just a sort of like fear-based training. They're taught from day one in the academy, and it's reinforced all through their careers, that they are taught to fear that at any moment they can be shot and killed by anybody.
And on that point then, and I want to try to draw you out on this connection that you kind of muse a little bit about again in the piece between this kind of training and some of these police shootings. How many police shootings of citizens in the United States typically involve citizens who are armed with guns? I mean, what are the statistics on
that? Yeah, okay, so that's a good question, because we don't know, really. I mean, we've only known this over the past 2 years because the Washington Post and a couple other organizations, The Guardian, have started tallying up the deadly force encounters, they're called, where the police shoot somebody, whether they're armed or unarmed. And the past 2 years, it's run around 1,000 people. We don't know what the totals were in the past, even 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. So there's really no way to say cops are killing more people today than they were 10, 20, 30 years ago. There's no way to say, because the federal government did not compel local agencies, police agencies, to report that data. And in fact, before Obama left office, he put something in place to enforce that reporting of data. And I don't think Jeff Sessions, this is Trump's new attorney general, is too keen on that. I don't think this is a high on his priority list. So we don't know where that's going to go. But so it's about 1,000 people a year. Of those 1,000, the majority of them are armed. And that doesn't mean armed with a gun. They could be armed with a bat. They could be armed with a knife. So maybe 60% are armed. Mm. I think the figure might be more. Maybe 60-70% are armed. And of that percentage, really, we're talking about, when I say shootings of civilians that might look like they didn't have to happen, that something else could have been done. Cops could have been trained in a way to avoid that situation, to avoid using deadly force. I would say maybe 200 to 300 of those.
Hmm.
Okay, and they sometimes involve people who are unarmed, but they could also involve someone who's mentally ill, who
right.
maybe has a knife, who is acting oddly, and cops largely aren't trained at this point, although it's changing, I think, to interact with somebody who's acting strangely, but also might be a threat to others.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Steve Featherstone about his piece in The New Republic concerning trends in policing. I want to ask you a more specific question about that training in terms of how police officers are trained under this warrior policing mentality in terms of time of reaction.
Yeah.
Is there a different orientation toward in the encounter with a civilian who may or may not be a threat or may or may not be breaking a law, in terms of the time to response? How's that viewed?
That's a good question. And I think this is completely subjective. But when you talk to cops, they'll tell you something. There's no such thing as a typical encounter with a civilian, because it could turn deadly at any moment. Now, that's part of that reinforcement through their training, that they could be killed at any moment by anybody. But the fact of the matter is, we live in a violent culture. We live in a violent country by Western standards. There's more guns. I think the latest figure was something, there's a gun for every man, woman, and child, mm-hmm. and perhaps even more. So, I mean, I don't think the fear is unfounded for cops to think that they might be killed at any moment by anybody. But I think that we should look maybe at a concrete example. The Philando Castile. He was the gentleman who was pulled over by an officer outside of Minnesota in July 2016.
In Minneapolis, right?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, Minneapolis. That's right. Yeah, Minneapolis. And he was pulled over. The cop walked up to the car, asked for license and registration. Philando Castile, he complied. And then when he told the officer that he had a gun, the officer, in my view, panicked and in seconds shot Castile dead. And we came to know about this through, I think maybe a lot of your listeners will remember that Facebook live feed that mm-hmm. Castile's girlfriend had put up as him dying in his car. This is really gruesome footage and the four-year-old in the back seat. Now, when you talk about time to response, I think from the moment he was pulled over to the moment that Castile was shot by Officer Yanez, I think it was less than a minute. Mm-hmm. And you got another instance I mentioned in the article. There's a Native American gentleman in Seattle a couple of years ago was walking through an intersection holding a block of wood and a knife because he was a wood carver. Of course, the cop didn't know this. The cop sees someone in the crosswalk. He jumps out of his car, calls to the guy. The guy doesn't respond, and bang, bang, he's dead. Now, this was recorded on dash cam. That happened in less than 10 seconds, that encounter. So you have to think. I mean, these people were not deadly threats. They weren't pointing weapons at anybody. They weren't pointing weapons at the officer, whether it was a knife or a gun. Castile was armed, but his gun was, I believe, was in his pocket, was not shown. His hands were showing.
And he told the police officer he had it.
Exactly. He told the police officer that he had a license. And then that's when the officer, in my view, he panicked and shot him.
Now, you also muse a bit in the piece about how this way of policing relates to trust in the community, and particularly then the connection to some of these police shootings of the kind that you've just described. How does that relate in your view?
Well, I think a really good example, and I talk a little bit about this in the article, is the Ferguson case. And it's really interesting, this case, because – and the Department of Justice investigation bears this out – that the shooting itself was a was not controversial. It was controversial. I know that. What I'm saying is the shooting of Michael Brown.
It was found to be basically a good shooting.
Yeah,
so to
exactly.
Speak.
Darren Wilson. Yeah, there was an altercation, and Darren Wilson shot him. And the Department of Justice investigation proved that this was justified. That he did not. There was a justified shooting. However, the context in which that happened, the city of Ferguson had been for years. Mm-hmm. The police department was abusive, to put it lightly. And not just the police department; it's the whole city, the whole system, the whole municipal system. The courts were incredibly abusive to, especially the African American community. And this is the context that's happening. And I think there was this air of mistrust and grievance that even though that shooting might have been justified, the violence that occurred after. And when I say the violence, I'm talking about the riots. I'm not even sure riot's the right word. But the demonstrations, the protests, the burning, the throwing of the rocks, that outburst was coming out of that context of being police abuses over the years, and of course the police response to that was to amp it up. It was absolutely a militarized response. We saw the armored personnel carriers coming out to the protest with snipers on the roofs. You know, it was nuts. Rather than respond in a calm manner, the police just amped it up.
You're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with the writer and journalist Steve Featherstone. He has a piece in the May edition of The New Republic about policing and police training titled Professor Carnage. Well, I want to go back to this topic of the way that police get trained and the mindset that police have and how it might have changed over recent decades, because we talked a little bit about this warrior policing concept, and you mentioned the sense that, you know, police have to react quickly because their lives are always in danger, and that what the effects of that might be on the way that they would handle any particular encounter. But there's another aspect of this, too, which is how the perceived nature of the job of a police officer has changed in light of some high-profile mass killings, such as Columbine and Aurora and Sandy Hook. I mean, the lesson that comes out of that over and over again for policing is that, you know, you've got to get in there right away and you've got to take out that shooter.
Yeah,
I mean, you
yes.
can't wait like what happened
in Columbine
and right. in also at Virginia Tech.
You That's
know,
right.
that was the lesson that comes out of that. So how do you train a police officer to be the front line, in a sense, in the war against domestic terror? I mean, it's not terrorism from ISIS, but, you know, it's still a terrorism of a kind. How do you train the police officer to be that first line of response without turning the police officer into a warrior?
Yeah, well, how do you thread that
that's
needle? That's a great question. In fact, that was one of the sort of the gaps I tried to bridge in this article, because I think one of the people I spoke to, the professor of law at the University of South Carolina, put it best when he said that, like, you know, the kind of cop that he argues for is called he would call a guardian cop, and the guardian cop is someone who's is trying to protect the dignity and safety, of course, of people in the community. The warrior cop is just more or less out to protect, you know, out to protect and provide safety. The dignity part isn't there. Now, the guardian cop still can be a warrior. I mean, they can still have all that training to respond to what they call, your example is called an active shooter, because that really did change the game in the late 90s. There was a North Hollywood shootout. Do you remember that one in the bank, right? Do you remember how many cops were on scene? There were dozens of cops on scene. They couldn't stop it. They literally went on for like an hour. The guys in the street shooting AK-47s, they couldn't put the guys down. The SWAT team eventually did. And that's exactly what SWAT teams are for. But, you know, that changed the game, you know, and then Columbine changed the game. 9/11 changed the game, because cops really are on the front lines of not only mass shootings, but potential terror attacks. And they do need to be warriors at times. The question is, do they need to be warriors all the time? Mm. And I would have to say, obviously, as horrible as these and really frequent compared to other countries, these mass killings are, They're not as frequent as it would warrant to be a cop to be a warrior all the time. You know, it's just a fraction of their job. You know, most cops are never going to, as we know from statistics, most cops are never even going to shoot their gun on duty.
Hmm. If you just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, and my guest is the writer and journalist Steve Featherstone. Now, you've got a very interesting wrinkle in this piece, I thought, which is the inclusion of your father in it. He's a character in
yep.
this. He's a character in your
yes,
article.
He is.
And
a character in other ways.
and you did make this interesting decision to include him. Tell me about that decision and the experience that you had bringing him along.
It's funny. It's one of the reasons why I agreed to do the story, because it's not the typical story for me, but the opportunity to have, you know, to bring my dad into it was what made it interesting and fun, I guess. A little bit about my dad. He was a retired captain on the Syracuse City Police Department and served 35 years. And I think at one time, I don't know if this is still true, he was the most decorated officer in the history of the department. And this might have been back in the 80s. He had won the top award for bravery like twice. I don't know why. I never knew anything about what he did on the job. He never talked about it at home. But for this story, when I took him down to watch Professor Carnage, Dave Grossman, do his warrior thing, I brought my dad along to see, you know, okay, my dad comes from an era of policing that's very different than today's sort of militarized warrior cop. I wouldn't say my dad is a guardian, some people want cops to be. He was kind of more, I guess, sort of Dirty Harry, but not as mean, I guess. he came from an era where, I guess, when I asked how he would solve certain situations, deadly threats and whatnot, he would always chalk it up to common sense. This is what my mom and dad taught me. And not the police academy, not anything else. It's common sense. This is what you do. Let me give you an example. and I talk about this in the piece, there is he encountered a gentleman in the hallway of a housing project who was armed with a knife, and he was seen to be probably mentally ill. I think that turned out to be the case, but you never know. It could be drunk. It could be a lot of things. And when he told the story, how it ended was he and his partner rushed the guy. They rushed him and grappled with a knife. That's the kind of stuff you see on TV. Mm-hmm. It's something that cops typically don't do now. In fact, they're generally trained.
Hard to imagine that that person wouldn't have been shot.
Shot
today.
Dead, yeah. Yeah. It probably, you know, maybe it goes without saying. I mean, when I think of that scenario now, it's hard not to see how that guy doesn't end up dead. And I was like, well, Dad, you know, did you ever think of killing him? I was like, no, I never saw the shooting. I didn't think it was necessary. And I said, well, why? I mean, how is running at him and endangering your own life going to solve it? He goes, well, I didn't see any other way around it. I mean, it was either that or he was, you know, risk the chance that he's going to turn around and enter somebody's apartment and maybe stab somebody. But the point was he wasn't going to go quietly, and so we had to do something. The interesting part of that story is that even though he grappled with the guy, he managed to get the guy to put the knife in his pocket. And he did that by using sort of a common sense de-escalation technique. He talked to the guy. He said, you know, sir, you know, you've got this knife. Can you please put it away? You're scaring people. And he just talked calmly, slowly, and just sort of de-escalated the situation. He wasn't trained to do this. He just chalked it up to common sense.
Well, in just a couple minutes that we have, I want to stick with your father because it is such an interesting part of this. But to round out that profile that you just gave of him, it's also the case, though, that he's not this, or at least in the article, he doesn't come across this way, as necessarily as warm and fuzzy guy. So you're not describing somebody that's going to be like, let's just talk all the time, you know, and all be friends.
No,
I mean, he's got kind of a no nonsense side to him,
no
right?
No one would ever confuse Captain Featherstone or Sergeant Featherstone or Patrolman Featherstone with Officer Friendly. I mean, he was what he called fair and reasonable is how he would describe himself, I think. Another situation he talked about that really kind of brought this to mind for me was he had encountered another guy in a domestic call who was upset. He had went up a set of stairs with his partner, and he could hear behind the door as they knocked the shucking of a shotgun, like that sound of a shotgun. And rather than back down or bust through the door or whatever, they literally just opened the door, and the guy with the shotgun was just standing right there. And I mean, it was just a split second. It could have gone either way. Neither guy panicked, not my dad, not the other guy. And it was just amazing to me that this somehow situation after situation that he described didn't end up with somebody dead. That was the key that I try to get at. And I know that all this is anecdotal. And I also I'm not suggesting that in every situation that I'm talking about here that some other cop would have killed the guy.
Right,
that's not the point. But in a situation that he described, not just him but all of his colleagues, the goal was never to sort of put down the person who was making the threats.
That was Steve Featherstone. Again, his recent piece is titled Professor Carnage, and you can find it in the May edition of The New Republic. Steve, thanks so much for talking with me.
Oh, thank you, Grant.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest. And if you'd like to hear more of this conversation, you can find additional material on the Campbell Conversations webpage at WRVO.org under the Local Programming tab.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Mark Lavonier. Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.